Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibe. This week on Culturetopia, a new documentary that follows the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond as he tries to adapt his hit TV series into a Russian sitcom. The stealth progressive force that is the Fast and the Furious car chase films. And rapper Ice-T on his new autobiography that shows his rise from South Central Los Angeles to Hollywood. But first,
Gaddafi's brutal regime has affected Libya's literature as well. Some of its finest novelists write veiled narratives filled with allegory and a kind of Baroque symbolism. Hisham Matar is one novelist who's chosen to take on the repression directly, both in his critically acclaimed first novel and now his new one, Anatomy of a Disappearance. We reached him at his home in London. Hisham Matar says when Muammar Gaddafi first came to power as a revolutionary liberator, he ushered in a brief golden age of literature, a golden age that ended completely and suddenly in the late 1970s.
In 1 year, he imprisoned a huge number of writers. They were almost kind of trapped. You know, the Revolutionary Committee set up a sort of big literary festival, if you like, and then they just captured all the writers, they tortured them, and they put them in prison. And that generation of writers spent minimum 10 years in prison. I know people who have been in prison for 15 years just because their only crime is that they're a novelist or a poet or a short story writer.
So Gaddafi set up a sort of trap. He actually put on the festival in order to round up the writers?
Yes, but he also sent trucks. For example, I remember as a young boy, all these beautiful bookshops in Tripoli, army trucks went to them with lists of books that the regime had decided were not appropriate, and these books were gathered up and burnt in the Green Square. So writers have for a long time been problematic for the regime. Dictatorship, by its essence, is interested in one narrative, an intolerant narrative, and writers are interested in a multiplicity of narratives and conflicting empathies and what the other is thinking and feeling. And that completely unsettles the dictatorial project.
Your own writing is much more forthright about political experiences than some others. Both of your novels deal with a political disappearance. And I wonder if that is inspired, it certainly is similar to something in your own life, and that is that your father was kidnapped in Cairo 21 years ago and has been missing ever since.
You're right in the sense that what has happened to my father, who was a political dissident who was tortured, imprisoned, and then disappears in the political prisons in Libya, so we continue not to know whether he's alive or dead. When somebody dies, it's final, or at least to us it seems final. But when somebody disappears, the possibility of them existing in the same moment, in the same day, the same year, under the same moon, under the same sun, is a very vivid possibility. And what it does to the nature of the grief is uniquely different from the nature of the grief and longing when somebody dies. And so I wanted to try to make something hopefully beautiful from this, which on some level to me, doing that, in other words, being able to sing about the terrible things, to me is an act of resistance. It is a way to say, I will make art even out of this.
You wrote in the first days of these protests in March about the fact that one of the early effects of those protests was the release of prisoners, and among them was your uncle and your two cousins, who had been in prison since 1990. What was the first thing that your uncle said to you?
Actually, the first thing that my uncle said to me when I spoke with him over the phone was, what's this I hear about you being shortlisted for the Booker Prize? So my uncle was keen to remind me that he was connected to the world. And then we talked for a long time because he was in the car being driven home. So we talked for about an hour. And there was this wonderful portion of our conversation in which every sentence he said started with, do you remember? And, you know, it was a marvelous proof, you know, his humor, his ability to remember all these wonderful details when I was young, how he used to push my bike, how the sort of cinnamon hot drinks I liked when I was a kid, and all of these things that he remembered just reminded me how, you know, there's only so much you can do to a man. You know, you can do a great deal. You could steal from them time and ability and possibility. But you can't erase that thing, that spirit, you know. And I'm amazed by my uncle Mahmoud Matar, because he's speaking about forgiveness and he's speaking about, you know, reconciliation. And it's a marvelous thing. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Hisham Matar's latest novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, comes out in the U.S. this summer.
An unapologetically brash Hollywood blockbuster races into theaters this weekend.
Chances are, sooner or later, we're going to end up behind bars or buried in a ditch somewhere. But not today.
Fast cars, fast women, sun-kissed backdrops, Fast 5 is the fourth sequel in the hugely successful Fast and Furious franchise. The films do not charm most critics, but one of them, Wesley Morris, calls the series the most progressive force in Hollywood. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, progressive, that's an interesting term. It's not a word that you would naturally hear attached to a bang-em-up speed flick, so make your case.
Well, basically the thing that I'm most interested in with this series is that it promotes race as this very normal thing. And around these cars are these very different types of people, but it's not the subject of the movie the way it is in most Hollywood movies. Race is just a matter of fact. It is not the way people conduct their business. It is not a cause of friction. It just people happen to be Asian, Hispanic, Black, white. Doesn't matter. They just really want to steal the cars and catch the people who've stolen them.
And by race, you're talking about sort of a multi-ethnic approach in the casting, the packaging, and the marketing.
Everything. I mean, it's not just multiracial. It's interracial. It's polyracial. Race has just kind of exploded into such a thing in these movies that it almost doesn't even matter.
So does this happen naturally? Is it sort of organic, or is it much like Sesame Street or High School Musical, where it looked like this was just sort of this natural multi-ethnic environment, but behind the scenes, there are a lot of people who were carefully making these decisions in order to reach out to a specific audience?
I think initially it seemed that way. I mean, Vin Diesel's production company is called One Race Productions or One Race Films, and I think that he is one of those people who's frequently kind of annoyed by having to deal with and answer questions about, what are you? What background are you? And I think that one of the things he wants to try to do with these movies, whether consciously or not, in achieving that effect, is to sort of eliminate race as a point of conflict and use race as a point of normalcy, which I think is a really revolutionary thing to be able to try to do and achieve in a movie that's made almost, well, by the time this fifth movie opens, it'll be well over $1 billion at the box office.
These films are not exactly, shall we say, deep?
They're not.
There's a lot of fast cars, and there's not, exactly nuanced social commentary. And in fact, The Onion did a recent spoof that we should listen to before we go on. Let's take a quick listen.
We're so excited to welcome one of Hollywood's brightest creative talents, the screenwriter behind this summer's blockbuster, the new Fast and the Furious movie, Fast 5. Chris Morgan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Chris. Now, Chris, these Fast and the Furious movies are just getting bigger and better. So when you sat down to write this installment, were there certain elements you wanted to include?
I want the cars to drive fast and then some of them explode.
Oh, that sounds so great. Now, believe me,
so what you're hearing there is a child saying, I wanted the cars to go fast and then to explode, which is essentially what happens over and over and over again in these films.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think that there's a degree to which the infantile aspect of the way the movies are laid out serves a really interesting corollary to how this race thing functions. I mean, the audience who sees this movie is not going to leave this movie saying, wow, it was so awesome to see all those people of color just hanging out like normal. That's their life. There's nothing to talk about. It's taken for granted. That's just the way it is. But to Hollywood, I think, I can't overemphasize enough how unique that is, where The Blind Side, for instance, is a movie that made well over $200 million, but it's also a movie that's in many ways about the way we tend to see race in America after 100 years of movies.
And we were talking about the story of a white Southern woman who takes in a homeless and very large Black young man who winds up playing on the football team.
You would think the story would be about him and having a bad mother and being virtually homeless and not having any options, and this woman comes into his life. But the movie is actually about the woman and how good it is that she's brought this kid into her life. It's a vehicle for her goodness. And sort of by extension, it tells the story of the history of race in Hollywood. It fosters a very sort of familiar liberal idea, which is that I, white person, will make myself feel better by bringing you, black person, into my life.
You know, there are a lot of people who are interested in seeing more nuanced or sort of more multidimensional portrayals of people of color on screen. And to them, Fast Five is, you know, while they applaud the success, it is also somewhat of a disappointment because the women are always clad in bikinis and because, you know, the characters are not, they do not necessarily come across as particularly deep or intellectual.
That's a fair criticism. I just feel like all the characters are shallow, not just the women, and all the characters are hot, not just the women, and all the characters have their clothes off, not just the women. It's an equal opportunity shallow here, and I do think that there is a huge dearth of movies that deal with race seriously, but I don't know. I mean, I feel like this movie's a huge success for treating race as something we deal with every day. And I think that part of the popularity of this series is that it looks like the world that a lot of the people who pay money to see these movies, it looks like the world they live in. And that isn't ever really the case in most Hollywood movies, even in 2011.
Wesley Morris, thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Michelle.
That's Wesley Morris. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe.
In the mid-1990s, comedy writer Phil Rosenthal scored a huge hit with his sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond.
Hi, I'm Ray, and I live here in Long Island with my wife, Deborah.
It's very likely you have seen the show. It was about the Barone family and the small annoyances that we all encounter in daily life, leaving clothes on the floor or drinking from the milk carton, that kind of stuff. And 33 million viewers tuned in to watch the finale in 2005. Now, after the series ended, it found a second life in syndication, but it also got the attention of the Russians. They wanted to turn Everybody Loves Raymond into Everybody Loves Костя.
Костя, спортивный журналист.
Смотреть хоккей, футбол, еще за это деньги получают.
But would it work? Now, the sitcom format is still relatively new to Russian television, and so American networks have been pushing to bring them to the Russian market. And that's what happened to Phil Rosenthal in 2009.
The head of Sony called me in his office a few years ago, and he told me that Sony created the sitcom in Russia.
There was no All in the Family or
no.
Cosby Show. There's nothing like that.
Nothing like that.
It did not exist in Russia.
No. Until Sony brought The Nanny, the show The Nanny, over there and translated their episodes into Russian, cast Russian actors and put it on Russian TV, and it became a huge hit.
So The Nanny was groundbreaking, historic
yes.
television in Russia.
Yes, the first ever sitcom.
So the head of Sony said to you, we think this can work with Everybody Loves Raymond. Let's give it a shot. That's basically what he said?
Actually, what he said was, how would you like to go over there and observe how we work with the Russians, come back and write a fictional feature film about a showrunner who goes over there to have his show translated? And I said, oh, well, that sounds good, but if the situation exists and the people you're telling me about really exist, why not bring a camera crew over and film what would really happen? And he said, I love that idea. Would you be the guy? And I said, yeah, I want to make that movie. And he goes, no, make your movie, but be the guy in the movie. Go do your show over there.
So you go to Russia.
Yep.
And you're thinking, this is a no-brainer, simple premise, it's a family comedy, this is universal stuff, right? And you could actually make this happen. You could make Everybody Loves Raymond in Russia, but then you get to Russia, and what do you find out?
They have other plans. I didn't think it would be a slam dunk, but I was led to believe that we could have something universal in the premise of our show because it is so simple. It's just about a family.
And it takes place in a house.
It takes place in a house, the wife and the husband, the parents bother you, the kids sometimes. So why wouldn't it be? I mean, we're in 148 countries, our version, dubbed or subtitled. We still get letters from Sri Lanka. That's my mother.
Hmm.
When I got to Russia, they said to me, real life is terrible. Why would we put that on television?
They said, no one thinks that real life is funny.
That's right.
Was The Nanny, wasn't that rooted in some reality at all?
Have you seen it?
No, I had the Russian version, no.
Have you seen the American version?
A couple times, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's not by definition, rooted in reality. It was a fantasy show. It was a broad, cartoony type of show on purpose. Nothing wrong with it. It's just that our show was about the minutiae of daily life and the petty family squabbles that we all have and how we take the little things in life and blow them up to become big things. They didn't think that this would play with their audience.
Not only that, they didn't think it was funny.
Well, yeah. When I would see them rehearsing their way of doing it, which was to make it much broader, I didn't see them laughing either, which gave me reason to say, why don't you try it, you know, in a realistic, naturalistic way? Which, by the way, is the tradition of the Russians, if you look at theater, which comes from there, Stanislavski, Chekhov, right? It's their tradition. But when it comes to sitcoms and what the executives think the audience out there will like, the rules are different somehow.
For example, one of the staffers, the costume designer, she wanted to dress these characters, ostensibly a middle-class family. She wanted to dress them in designer clothing at home.
Yes.
You were trying to explain to her that this was simply unrealistic. But she pushed back. She said, no, the show should have some flair, a sense of style.
Yes, and I'm saying, look at this character right now in front of us. She's wearing a cashmere sweater, fancy pants, high heels, jewelry. I said, you understand she's cleaning the house, right? And she says, yes, but she's on television. And I said, yes, but she doesn't know she's on television. She thinks she's cleaning.
So what makes Raymond appealing and funny to American audiences, at least, is that he's kind of this bumbling guy, kind of a pushover at times. But that was actually a big challenge in Russia because they thought he was this loser who wasn't funny at all.
I was told that the Russian men are way more macho than American men.
Right.
And no way does the wife, rule the house. And I thought, just listening to this, that this was baloney. That you can have this outer shell of macho and this is what you want to present to the world and this is what you want to present even to, you know, yourselves. But I just don't believe it. I think you could be the most macho guy in the world and as soon as you get in the house, the wife is telling you to pick up your socks.
When you started casting for the roles, you had the Russian actors adapt a particular scene. I'm going to play it in the original English. And so this is from Everybody Loves Raymond. This is the scene about the Fruit of the Month Club.
Your birthday gift to me finally came this morning. And did you know you sent me a box of pears?
Yeah, yeah.
From a place called Fruit of the Month?
That's right, that's right. How are they?
Oh, they're very nice pears. But there's so many of them. There are over a dozen pears. What am I supposed to do with all those pears?
Well, I think you're supposed to eat them.
Myself?
You and Dad and Robert.
How many pears can Robert eat? Look, I appreciate the thought, Raymond, but please don't ever send us any more food again, okay? Thanks.
Well, another box is coming next month.
What? More pears?
No, it's a different fruit every month.
Every month?
Yes, yes, that's why they call it Fruit of the Month Club.
It's a club? Oh my God, what am I going to do with all this fruit?
Okay, now there is no Fruit of the Month Club in Russia, so what do the Russians do with this scene?
They changed it to Water of the Week.
And does that exist in Russia, Water of the Week?
No, that doesn't exist either. But for some reason, that was going to be more relatable to them, which is fine with me. I just happen to think this is a personal, subjective opinion that fruit is funnier than water.
So do they consult with you, the writers who are working on Everybody Loves Kostya? Do they contact
No.
you? No, that's it. It's you're done.
I like to think I had a great influence on them and that they saw things my way. What I think happened was they said, oh, you're very smart. Thank you for coming. Goodbye. And then did whatever the hell they wanted.
I know the show is in countries around the world. And I've heard that you may be bringing it to Israel and to Poland next. Is that true?
Poland did call. They do want the show. I'm not going.
You're not going to get involved.
I get the whole Eastern European thing now. I've done it. That's it.
Israel,
I visited Israel once. I found it to be a lot like Hebrew school.
So you're not getting involved either.
No, I there's a terrific guy over there who's going to adapt the show, who's a big sitcom hero over there in Israel where they do have sitcoms. Mm. So he has my blessing. Go ahead. By the way, I'm here if they want to call me and ask for anything, but I don't think they need to, and I don't think I should expect them to. I learned that it's for them. They have to do it their way, and I have to let go. I have to be a big boy.
That's writer-director Phil Rosenthal. His documentary is called Exporting Raymond. It's out in theaters now, and it's about his journey to adapt his hit TV show Everybody Loves Raymond for a Russian audience. Phil Rosenthal, thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
During his career, Ice-T has played many roles. He first came to national attention as the godfather of gangster rap.
6 in the morning, police at my door. Fresh Adidas squeak across the bathroom floor. Out my back window, I'm gonna escape. Didn't even get a chance to grab my old school tape.
And then became the focus of a national controversy with his rock band, Body Count.
I got my 12-gauge sawed off. I got my headlights turned on. I'm about to bust some shots off.
He broke into movies as a cop chasing down Chris Rock in New Jack City.
Everybody out! Get down! Back. Everybody down! Police! You think you slick, you little punk blast, Miss Dope Fiend?
But he's best known as Detective Finn Tatula on Law & Order SVU.
You're my son. I love you. But a woman's dead, her son's gone, her husband's destroyed. That's got to mean something to you. I need you to decide right now what kind of man you want to be.
In a new memoir, Ice-T describes his childhood in New Jersey, gang culture in South Central L.A., his time as a hustler and a pimp, and what he calls his redemption. And Ice-T joins us from our bureau in New York. His new book is Ice, A Memoir of Gangster Life and Redemption from South Central to Hollywood. And it's nice to have you with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Hey, thanks for having me. That was a great intro.
I'm glad you liked it. Does anybody call you Tracy anymore?
You know, some of my old friends, you know, every once in a while I hear somebody call me Tracy. They're trying to let me know that they know me, you know, personally. But most of my real friends would call me Trey, or Ice was basically short for Iceberg. So they would call me, some of my boys call me Berg.
You write in the book, when you got to Los Angeles after childhood in New Jersey, your parents both died in heart attacks.
Yeah.
And you moved to a place you didn't know, but you thought Tracy sounded like a girl's name.
Well, no, I knew that my whole life. You know, Johnny Cash had a record called Boy Named Sue. You know, so if you give a boy any name that, you know, could be considered a girl's name, he's going to grow up tough. So, you know, I was like, okay, every time I meet a guy and he goes, oh, that ain't a, they don't say it's a girl's name. They say that's a bee's name, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, now I got to fight you right now, you know, to prove I'm not. So I was like, you know what, I'll call myself Trey. And eventually I started to read books by Iceberg Slims, and people used to say, say more, some more of that Iceberg stuff, T. And it turned into Ice-T, means cool tea.
Iceberg Slim, of course, an old-time hustler from the 40s and 30s,
yeah.
And, well, among other things, the author of Pimp.
Right.
And a trade you got into later.
Well, you know, I idolized Iceberg Slims when I was in high school, and it was something I thought I wanted to do. And I tested my hand in that game, but that's not easy, you know? And I eventually dawned on me, I'm like, if I admire this man so much, really he's an author, you know? And I'm like, if I really want to be like him, instead of worrying about really living it out, let me document the game. That's why I respect him. So my life was kind of, you know, crazy at the time. I was out there breaking the law. And when I started to make music, I'd made music about that lifestyle, you know, in an attempt to kind of mimic Iceberg Slim through music.
A lot of misconceptions about what you were doing stemmed from the fact that as you were writing these songs, you were, in a sense, creating characters, telling stories.
Well, no, I mean, I couldn't possibly have lived all the things that Ice-T and the records have lived. I did what I called faction. It was like factual situations, not always for me, but put in a fictional settings. And that way I could create, you know, these great adventures and these great stories and all these things. So it had to happen to somebody. And I'm like, you would tell me a story about a brush with the law or something like that, and I would get all the details. And I would mix them with things that have happened to me, and that's what I would use for my material. But nah, come on. I mean, I wouldn't be standing here today. I mean, Ice-T and the music has done some outrageous things.
But it's interesting, some of the most compelling parts of your book, I thought, were the stories of going first to middle school and then later high school in Los Angeles as a sort of wide-eyed kid from the suburbs of New Jersey.
Absolutely.
And discovering gang culture, among other things. And you and two of your friends, in fact, invented your own gang.
That was a survival tactic, you know. I mean, like, yeah, you're right. My mother passed when I was in third grade. My father in the seventh. I shipped to L.A. to live with my aunt. living still in a nice middle class area of Los Angeles. But then I decided I wanted to go to the roughest high school probably in the country, Crenshaw High School. And there were the gangs. So these gangs coming from the avenues, there were 100 guys in the gang. There was three of us coming from our neighborhood. So we convinced the school that we had a gang, that there were more of us. You just don't know us.
And up in the hills somewhere.
Up in the hills somewhere, and kept them off of us. You know, we had to improvise at the time.
Yet one of the things that you made clear in your music, and it's interesting you talk about it in the book too, is that you were never shy about, you did some things that were on the wrong side of the law, and you were never shy about explaining exactly what that was throughout your life.
Well, you know, I think you got to meet the enemy before they meet you. It's no sense in me trying to come out as a musician and just act like I never did it. Somebody was going to say, hey, this guy, you know, he's no angel, you know, but that was the opportunities that were available to me at that time, you know. And as I started to get more opportunities, I tried to make the correct decisions. And that's why I think I'm sitting here now, you know, telling this story. I mean, who would ever thought a kid from South Central that was in serious trouble would end up being on television playing a cop?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I had to start making some right decisions sooner or later.
It's interesting that you write, in fact, you made a decision that if you were going to become famous, your past would never escape you. It would always be with you, so you might as well come out with it early.
Absolutely, and it's stuff that you never get rid of. You know, I mean, when you come from that environment, a violent background, you know, I'm at nice parties now, and I'm still checking where the escapes are, the doors are. You know, if you usually, you could see me in a nice party in the Hamptons someplace, and I'll have my back up against the wall. It's stuff that just gets stuck in you for life, you know. But it's funny, when I started to act, I always got casted as a cop. And, you know, I asked the lady one time, a casting agent, and they were like, well, to cast a street cat as a street cat, that's no acting. But if I cast you as a cop, we get a policeman with an interesting dynamic. And that's what you're seeing on Law and Order right now.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I guess you got to call it acting.
Well, it's interesting about that. You describe, I think it's your second movie. You're working with Denzel Washington and are
struck
by what some in the industry call acute awe. Oh, my gosh, I'm working with Denzel Washington. And he had some advice for you.
Come on. We all start off fans, you know. Before you play in the NBA, you sit on the sideline and look at him and say, man, one day. So to be actually working with Denzel Washington, are you serious? You know, I'm a rapper, so I wasn't so starstruck with other MCs or musicians. But this was Denzel Washington. This is like my second movie. And Denzel would sit there and play with me and, you know, tell jokes. And then when they say action, he would snap into character. And he did it so fast that I couldn't say my lines. And he reached over the table. He popped me and said, come on, Ice. Come on, baby. Let's do this, you know. And he made me feel so comfortable. And, you know, I looked at him and I said, I want to learn how to act like that. I want to learn how to act like, be able to turn on a dime and just knock out my lines.
Ice-T, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
In 1975, Phoebe Snow went to the top of the charts with this song, Poetry Man. Snow died this morning at her home in Edison, New Jersey, of complications from a brain hemorrhage she suffered last year. She was 60 years old. Phoebe Snow's powerful, idiosyncratic voice connected with millions of listeners. NPR's Netta Ulaby has this remembrance.
Count among those moved by Phoebe Snow's hit, another powerful female musician, Queen Latifah.
My mom played Poetry Man a lot when I was a kid in the house. I mean, she played that album endlessly.
Queen Latifah's mom, Rita Owens, played it every Saturday while cleaning house.
I just love the song so much, the melody. And Phoebe Snow has such a unique voice.
You make me laugh, 'cause your eyes, they light the night, they look right through me.
Phoebe Phoebe Snow was born Phoebe Ann Laub. She actually thought she'd never be a singer because she was so shy. She told NPR in 1998 she made up a name for the hammy part of herself, the part unafraid to get up on stage in Greenwich Village coffee houses.
Large Marge, because I would just send Phoebe to the sidelines and say, okay, you're too scared, you go sit down, we have to send out Large Marge.
Phoebe Snow was no wispy pop princess when she landed on the cover of Rolling Stone after Poetry Man's success. She was baby-faced, big, with a crop of curls. Some people couldn't tell if she was black or white. Her parents were Jewish, music lovers, who made sure she could play piano and guitar. But Snow's four-octave voice could handle anything.
Got a little religion and I'm not ashamed. Somebody in heaven wrote down.
Phoebe Snow recorded 16 albums. Jim Chapdelaine co-produced one of her last.
She could be that sensitive Poetry Man kind of singer, or she could be this rip-roaring flamethrower of a voice that was staggering.
Hey!
It was even hard for me to find the right microphone to could even keep up with her. There was never anything emotionally unauthentic about what she was doing.
Soon after her first flush of success, Phoebe Snow had a daughter named Valerie, born with multiple disabilities. Doctors predicted Valerie would barely survive a few years. Then Snow's husband left her. Her child became her priority.
The great thing about my daughter is that she is a very courageous human being, and she's funny. She has a great sense of humor. She's the most affectionate person I've ever known. I get hugged 30 times a day until my head almost falls off, and I can't think of a better way for anybody to spend their life than to be loved so beautifully and unconditionally. She's my hero.
Snow was promoting an album with that interview, all covers. She'd picked one song because it summed up her feelings about Valerie.
I'll do you right, John. I'll be with you for the long haul. You're all I do it for.
Valerie died 4 years ago at the age of 31. Netta Ulibi, NPR News. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.